This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
Well, let's talk about good old Calvin here for a little bit. And that little clip gives you the kind of the big picture on his life. And what I'd like to do is kind of fill in some of the gaps on some of that, and particularly talk about his lasting influence. And when you think of Calvin, is already made mention in the film, you know, he is one of those individuals that it seems people either love or hate. Louis Spitz, who's a famous Reformation scholar, a Lutheran historian, has made this comment: Calvin was one of those strong and consistent men of history who people either liked or disliked, adored or abhorred. And I think that is certainly the truth. Let me just read you some comments of people that have honored Calvin and appreciated him, and particularly from some of his contemporaries, and then maybe some comments on the other side also. Most of you have heard of Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the famous Calvinist Baptist preacher. Once said this: "The longer I live, the clearer does it appear that John Calvin's system is the nearest to perfection." Or William Cunningham, who's a famous Scottish theologian, has done a well-known work on historical theology, said, "Calvin is the man who, next to St. Paul, has done most good to mankind." Or Philip Schaff, the historian: "Taking into account all of his failings, Calvin must be reckoned as one of the greatest and best of men whom God raised up in the history of Christianity." And even Pope Pius IV, who was the Roman pontiff in the year that Calvin died in 1564, said this: "The strength of that heretic, Calvin, consists in this: the money never had the slightest charm for him. If I had such servants, my dominion would extend from sea to sea." Or Theodore Beza, who knew him very well, his very close associate and successor when Calvin passed away, said this about his knowledge of John Calvin: "I've been a witness of him for 16 years, and I think that I'm fully entitled to say that in this man there was exhibited to all an example of the life and the death of a Christian, such as it will not be easy to deprecate, and which will be difficult to imitate." Now, on the other side, some of historians and persons that have not had as favorable a reaction to Calvin. Roland Bainton, interestingly, the famous Yale church historian that actually wrote a famous biography of Luther, among other works, once said this: "If Calvin ever wrote anything in favor of religious liberty, it was a typographical error." Well, what about this noted theologian, Jimmy Swaggart? "Calvin has, I believe, caused untold millions of souls to be damned." Or from some of the Calvin's contemporaries, some of his enemies in Geneva, said, "Better with Beza in hell than with Calvin in heaven." Even the Oxford Dictionary of the Christian Church has this as a part of its entry: "Calvin was the cruel and unopposed dictator of Geneva." And anyway, and finally, Voltaire, the French philosopher: "The famous Calvin, whom we regard as the Apostle of Geneva, raised himself up to the rank of the Pope of the Protestants." Well, he is one of those individuals that people either loved or hated. Here's some drawings of some of his students. And even his students, you know, had their ideas about their great teacher, where you see some of their etchings as they sat in class. Here's a picture I've always loved. I don't know who produced this, that actually he was a really cool dude. All right, we're moving along in our discussion of the different branches of the Reformation movement. We've looked at Luther, now we've talked about Zwingli, and then we've looked at the beginnings of the Free Church movement, which come out of the German-speaking Swiss Reformation. Now, the other tributary of the larger Reformed movement of Calvin's work in Switzerland, because of Zwingli's early demise in a battle, Calvin's influence is certainly going to have a much larger impact long term. Just to give you an idea of where we are now in our story, Calvin is born in 1509. And really, for all practical purposes, he is a second generation reformer. Okay? By the time he becomes an adult, Luther's work will have been going on for a good 20 years or so. And, you know, the year when he ends up in Geneva as a 27-year-old is about, 20 years after Luther posted the 95 Theses. So a lot has already transpired, which is some advantage to Calvin, because a lot of the initial issues have been dealt with, and Calvin's now going to expand the theology. But Luther, in the year that Calvin was born, Luther is lecturing at the University of Erfurt. Zwingli is the pastor in Glarus. And Henry VIII is 18 years old. And Henry VIII, of course, is going to be the head of the Church of England, which we'll talk about in our final major family of churches. But Protestantism is significantly disunified by the time Calvin comes on the scene. One of the things that Calvin will be known for is his ecumenical spirit. And he is going to participate in a number of dialogues with Lutherans, even with Roman Catholics, with the Zwinglians, and really trying to make good faith efforts to overcome some of these things. But Luther, by the time Calvin comes on the scene, Luther had a clear break with the Roman Catholics. He'd not been able to win over the humanists like Erasmus. The Marburg Colloquy had already happened about 7 or 8 years before Calvin's going to end up in Geneva, so that schism is in existence. And just 9 months before Calvin will write the Institutes of the Christian Religion, which is just before he's going to go to Geneva, the Munster Rebellion had happened. So all these things had already taken place, and it's the world into which he comes. And we talked last segment about Caspar Zwingli, one of these Anabaptist mystics, if you would. Zwingli once made this statement, talking about the tension between all the religious groups in Europe. Now, he said it in pretty crass terms. The Roman Catholics damned the Lutherans. The Lutherans damned the Zwinglians. The Zwinglians damn the Anabaptists, and the Anabaptists damn all the rest. And that's kind of the way it was. You were in a particular camp, and there just wasn't a whole lot of charitable feelings toward many of the others. And probably an overstatement to a certain extent, but yet you catch the flavor of the environment that Calvin is going to be ushered into when he emerges as the new leader there in Geneva. Now back to this earlier diagram of the history of the Swiss Reformation, you see where Zwingli has perished in 1531. All right, and Luther's going to live another 15 years. And Melanchthon is already continuing his work. Bullinger carries on the work in Zurich that Zwingli had begun. And remember, Zwingli's ideas had become embraced in a number of the cantons in Switzerland. So we're not talking about just Zurich. There were a number of them that were Zwinglian in orientation, and his works had been published and spread around. Some of them make their way into England, to other parts of Germany. But Bullinger is going to continue on there. He will have significant contact with Calvin. And northern and southern Protestant Swiss Protestant groups will have more and more contact and be able to come to some meeting of the minds on some issues, and his successor Beza will also have contact with Bullinger. Now, a number of the things we're going to look at here as we think about Calvin, you see a few of the important issues there in terms of the of Calvin's institutes, and then we're going particularly, I'm going to spend some time looking at this consensus Tigurinus in 1549, where Bullinger, Calvin, and Melanchthon are able to have conversation and come to more of a sense of unity on the Lord's Supper. And they really did have a strong desire to try to overcome some of those obstacles. Reformation historian Karl Hall has made this comment about Calvin. Calvin was Luther's greatest disciple. And of course, he didn't mean by that that Calvin was Lutheran in all the details of his theology, but the fact that he took those seminal ideas of Luther and then will expand them and articulate them really for not only Europe but the rest of the world eventually. And it's J.I. Packer who said, "Calvin orchestrated Protestant theology. Luther wrote most of the tunes." Talking about their relationship. There you've got the monument again with Farrell, Calvin, Beza, and John Knox there in Geneva. Okay, let's place Calvin on the map and kind of where we are. The Swiss Confederation, remember, right in the middle of the Holy Roman Empire. And these cantons had bound themselves together to protect themselves from any imposition of the Holy Roman Emperor. And so they had a military alliance and tried to keep things together. But what had happened, remember we saw this with Zwingli, that there, some of the cantons had remained staunchly Roman Catholic. Others had embraced the Zwinglian reform. All right, here's Zurich. And you've got Gaul and also Basel. Bern had adopted the Zwinglian reform. And then you've got Neuchâtel, which is the first French area to become Protestant. And then Geneva is going to decide for the Reformation. Here's Geneva down here. So you have your more Calvinist areas down here, directly influenced by Geneva. And then your Roman Catholic areas right in the middle of all of it. And remember, this had been the primary cause of Zwingli's demise because of the tension between Catholics and Protestants in this area. But let's look now at what's going to unfold in Geneva as Calvin will pick up with the work. Now, the video gave you some of the details of his early life, and we don't need to rehearse all of that. But Calvin, just like Luther, was early on recognized as a gifted young man and raised in the church and sent off to pursue his education. And his father wanted him to become a lawyer, just like Luther's father. It wanted him to do that. Part of the turn in Calvin's thinking about the church is that he had witnessed the burning of a Protestant there in France. And it caused him to think about what kind of understanding of the Bible and of Christianity would cause a person to die for their faith in a way like this. He had a cousin who had embraced Protestant thinking, and so he had also raised some questions about Catholicism. Now, France, where Calvin was born, is very similar to all the other nations of Europe at this time, where Lutheran pamphlets and ideas had begun to spread there. And so he is exposed to this in his studies and as he gets some clandestine copies of these things. And here's a map that has a few of the details of Calvin's life. You see over on the left-hand side, Paris, Orleans, and Bordeaux, with the little book symbols there where he had done some study. Calvin has a basic humanist education, and he had encountered this this man who became a close friend, the rector of the University of Paris, Nicholas Cop. And what got Calvin into trouble is he had actually written a sermon for Cop that he publicly delivered, which was condemned And when Cop's sermon was condemned and Calvin was implicated with that, they are eventually, by 1533, going to have to flee from Paris. And so this condemnation by Parliament, Calvin flees. And then, as the video showed, he goes to the home of this French noble, Louis du Tillet, who was a noble who had a library with 4,000 volumes. Now, that's a lot of books for an individual. You may think that's a lot of books for an individual to have today, but particularly in the 16th century. And Calvin just immersed himself in that library, reading the Fathers, studying the Scriptures, and it's in that that period that he begins to plan out the outline for the Institutes of the Christian Religion. Because he has had to flee France, and he has this deep burden that so many of his Protestant brethren in France are having to meet in secret, don't really have a firm foundation for their faith. What is it we really do believe? There's some basic tenets that they've embraced, that they've rejected in Catholicism, but they need to be taught the faith. If we're rejecting Catholicism, what are we putting in its place? And so he had a passion as a young scholar to write something that would basically communicate the faith, a manual of Christian belief, if you would, that he could provide for them. So he begins to think about these things, and then he has his sudden conversion. And part of this quote you saw in the video, it talks about him being involved in his legal profession and pursuing that. And then eventually, I withdrew from the study of philosophy, was put to the study of law. To this pursuit, I endeavored faithfully to apply myself, obedience to the will of my Father. But God, by the secret guidance of His providence, at length gave a different direction to my course. And then here we have his commentary on his conversion experience, if you would. It comes from his preface in the commentary on the Psalms in 1557. This is just 7 years before Calvin dies. But this is the little brief glimpse we get into his personal spiritual experience, and where he talks about how stuck he was in the superstitions of popery, but how God changed his mind. And you have a sense that it was a genuine turning to God, though. And though it's not described in the bold terms in which Luther would write about his own conversion experience, yet you see his real sense of God having met him and changed his heart and his mind. Well, in 1534, he meets Lefebvre, who is this famous French scholar who had been teaching some at the University of Paris, had produced a commentary on Romans, this humanist. And he had been calling for the reform of the church, and Calvin was intrigued by the ideas of this intellectual Frenchman. Well, fearing for their safety, Calvin and du Tillet are on their way to Strasbourg, and then want to make their way on to Basel to escape. And then that's where he is going to end up having to be sidetracked over to Geneva. But it is in Basel in 1536, while he is there, that his first edition of the Institutes of the Christian Religion is published. Now, this is going to be Calvin's major contribution. It's hard to say, you know, it's hard to suggest that maybe one portion of Calvin's works are more important than the others, but in terms of the long-term impact of a systematic theology of the faith, if you would. Because the Institutes, which he originally publishes now in 1536, is going to be expanded in multiple editions in his lifetime, and is going to go in its first edition from 6 chapters all the way to 80 chapters at the end. All the time, editing, adding new material. The substance of the original 1536 edition, though, is still in the later edition. I'll just suggest to you, if you ever have a chance to get it, because it's just fascinating to see what this young 27-year-old Frenchman understood about the faith. You can get copies of the 1536 edition. Now, a lot of this is introductory material. You know, the actual text is not incredibly long, particularly when you compare it with the two big volumes we have of the complete final editions of the Institutes. But the Institutes now are going to make its mark. Now, you need to know the background behind the Institutes and what, in addition to his desire to teach his brethren a basic theology of the Protestant faith. What had happened in 1534 is the infamous affair of the placards, and this is where the persecution of the French had started. And some of Calvin's friends had been caught by the authorities when were actually burned at the stake. And so he had personal associates deal with this. But what had happened is these young Protestants had gotten these billboards, if you would, or placards, and had written on these boards a criticism of the papacy and of the mass. And these were posted around Paris in different areas, and somebody actually snuck into the palace and attached one on the door of King Francis as he slept one night. Well, he was not amused when he woke up the next morning. And because of this affair of the placards, the fiery persecution of the Protestants had begun. Well, with that background, what Calvin ends up doing when he comes to write the Institutes and publish them in 1536, he wrote a very important preface. And this preface was to the work, incorporated with it. It was addressed to King Francis I. You can see King Francis there. And what he's doing is he's trying to convince the king, and he says, you know, I started out to write this little booklet for my fellow Frenchmen to explain the faith to them, but I have seen these fanatics in your country that are going about burning and killing all these Protestants. And so he's appealing to the French king to be open to reason and to present you this confession of our faith, if you would, that you might understand that we're not enemies of the crown. We're not fanatics. There had been, some Anabaptist ideas that had emerged in France. Not a lot, but the French king had certainly heard about these things. And so in his mind, he was associating these Protestants with what he had heard about what was going on in Germany among some of these Anabaptists. So Calvin is clearly trying to delineate himself as a distinct, and these Protestants as a distinct group from these Anabaptists. And all those kinds of things are addressed in this preface to St. Francis. And he lays out then the purpose of why he wants to write this work also. And you may be interested to know this, if you'll notice, looking under the title, even though it's Latin, you can pick up the word pietatis sumus, the sum of piety. And it's important to remember that Calvin, from the very beginning, as he penned this work, had in his mind that he wanted to produce something that would encourage piety among the French people, that is, faithful following of Christ. And it was not just a matter of cold scholastic doctrine, but it was a truth that engages the heart and transforms the life. And Calvin, that theme of piety is throughout the Institutes. And Calvin articulates the faith in a way that is very, very pastoral. Some of you have perhaps read some in the Institutes, and will recall that one of the favorite sections in the Institutes, which is unique if you think about contemporary systematic theologies, is he has a very lengthy discussion on prayer. It's one of my favorite parts in the Institutes, where Calvin goes to great lengths to talk about the importance of the life of prayer. And the Institutes have a real pastoral tone to them. Even the later editions, in dealing with all the Catholic errors and that kind of thing, he still is zeroing in on this life of piety. And again, as I mentioned, the reasons for him writing, to encourage piety, to distinguish themselves from these Anabaptists, to vindicate the deaths of some of these French Protestants, some of whom were his friends, to provide this instruction in the faith, to edify the French believers, and basically to lay out what Protestants believe. So there are a number of purposes in there in terms of what he was really trying to accomplish in putting this little work together. Now, before we take our break, let me just mention a few things about the letter to Francis the First. Some of the allegations, and this is the same kind of thing Luther had to deal with, but some of the allegations that had come against these French Protestants is these ideas you're embracing, these are all novelties. This is not what the church has believed for all these generations. This is contrary to the teaching of the fathers, the authoritative doctrines of the church. These are new sectarian doctrines, and they have no substance to them. And Calvin is going to reply in his address to St. Francis as he begins to engage with some of these accusations that, no, what we're really trying to do is to go back to the form of the ancient church. And he said, this is what we're attempting to lay out and to pursue. Well, some had also raised questions. This might seem odd to us. If this new Reformed church is of God, how come there are no miracles attached with it? You know, Catholics like the miracles. And Calvin's response is, all we need are the miracles of Christ. And we hold to the authority of the Word. These things are sufficient for us. And the Protestants were willing to be martyrs based upon their faith in the Word of God. And let me just read to you a little section out of of his prefatory address to Francis I, and you'll get a flavor for some of the things that he was addressing. He really goes into a number of these factors, but you see his appeal to the king. To His Most Christian Majesty, the most mighty and illustrious monarch, Francis, King of the French, his sovereign, John Calvin prays peace and salvation in Christ. Sire, when I first engaged in this work, nothing was farther from my thoughts than to write what should afterwards be presented to Your Majesty. My intention was only to furnish a kind of rudiments by which those who feel some interest in religion might be trained in true godliness. And I toiled at the task chiefly for the sake of my countrymen, the French, multitudes of whom I perceived to be hungering and thirsting after Christ, while very few seemed to have been duly imbued with even a slender knowledge of Him. This was the object which I had in view, which is apparent from the work itself, which is written in a simple and elementary form adapted for instruction. But when I perceived that the fury of certain bad men had risen to such a height in your realm that there was no place in it for sound doctrine, I thought it might be of service if I were in the same work both to give instruction to my countrymen and also to lay before Your Majesty a confession from which you may learn what the doctrine is that so inflames the rage of those madmen who are this day with fire and sword troubling your kingdom. For I fear not to declare that what I have here given may be regarded as a summary of the very doctrines which they vociferate, ought to be punished with confiscation, exile, imprisonment, and flames, as well as exterminated by land and sea. Your duty, most serene prince, is not to shut either your ears or mind against a cause involving such mighty interests as these, how the glory of God is to be maintained on the earth inviolate, how the truth of God is to preserve its dignity, and how the kingdom of Christ is to continue amongst us compact and secure. The cause is worthy of your ear, worthy of your investigation, worthy of your throne. So now with this appeal to Francis, he is going to present this to him. Many different editions of the Institutes are going to be produced over the years, and when we come back after the break, maybe we can pick up on that. And then I want to just say a few things about the influences. What kind of theology influenced Calvin to write the Institutes, and particularly in its mature form? He didn't just grab these ideas out of the air, because remember, he's coming 20 years into the Reform, and he availed himself of all the writings of the earlier Reformers before his time. And that's a part of what gives such a depth to Calvin's writings.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.